Good afternoon and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know. Find us on the internet at commonwealthclub.org. I'm Barbara Pivnica, Honorary Counsel of the Slovak Republic in California, CEO of the San Francisco Global Trade Council, and member of the Commonwealth Club's Board of Governors. I'll be your moderator for today's program. Today's program is being held in association with Commonwealth Club's International Relations Forum. It's now my pleasure to introduce our distinguished speaker, Dr. George Szapary, Ambassador of Hungary to the United States. Ambassador Szapary received a doctorate in economics from the University of Leuven in Belgium and began his career with the International Monetary Fund in Washington, D.C., where his last position was senior resident representative in Hungary. From 1993 to 2007, he was with the National Bank of Hungary, serving as its deputy governor and member of the Monetary Council. In 2010, he was appointed chief economic policy advisor to the Prime Minister of Hungary, and in January of this year was named Ambassador of Hungary to the United States. Ambassador Szapary is an author and frequent guest speaker at global economic forums and symposia, and is the recipient of the Sandor Popovic Award in recognition of his outstanding contributions in the field of monetary policy. As you know, Hungary currently holds the presidency of the Council of the EU, and we're very pleased to have Ambassador here with us today to discuss the current challenges and opportunities the EU faces. Please join me in welcoming Ambassador Szapary.
Thank you very much. It's a privilege for me to talk at the Commonwealth Club, one of the oldest, or not the oldest club in such club in the United States. As you know, the Hungarian government is holding the presidency of the EU. That lasts from January this year until the end of June. And I would like to talk to you a little bit about the priorities of the Hungarian presidency. Just a few words of what it involves to be the president, holding the presidency. There are about 250 task forces, committees, ministerial meetings that Hungarians are chairing. There have been so far about 700 such meetings, and the responsibility of the Hungarians is to set the agenda and make sure that the agenda progresses along the set program for the 6 months. Now, every country is interested to close one or two subjects during the presidency, because this is being regarded as a success of the presidency. Most of the items that are on the agenda are generally inherited from previous presidencies, because there are few issues that can be solved within 6 months. But it is a goal of each presidency to at least close one or two items on the agenda. Now, the Hungarian motto for the presidency is a strong Europe is a human touch. What is the strong Europe part of it? The strong Europe part of it is strengthening the governance, economic governance within the EU. As you know, Europe has gone through a crisis just like in the United States in 2008-2009, and as a result of that, there have been a big increase in unemployment, an increase in fiscal deficits, and in debt. And you have difficulties structural difficulties of debt management in Greece, Portugal, Iceland, Spain to some extent. In each of these countries, the source of the difficulties is different. In Ireland, for instance, it was because you had, in a small country, very large banks that were involved in international banking. And when the banking crisis hit the markets, these banks ended up with very large toxic assets as a ratio to GDP of Ireland. As a result of that, the bailing out of the banks meant a big involvement of the government compared to the GDP of Ireland. In Greece, it was a different issue. In Greece, for a long period of time, the fiscal deficit, the fiscal policy was very loose. The deficit has increased. It was not even fully known by the market how big is the deficit because it was hidden in the statistics. And when it hit the markets, then, of course, the full truth came to light, and it turned out that the deficit and the debt of the Greek government is much bigger than it was thought to be. In Portugal, for the last 10 years, Portugal has followed loose fiscal policy, but on top of it, it lost competitiveness. There was a wage boom in Portugal that created that led to a loss of competitiveness, loss of exports, and that was the major that is the major issue. So while the sources are different or have been different, the end result is very similar: high debt, high fiscal deficits, big unemployment. Now, having said that, what is what the European Union now tries to do? As you know, when the euro was established, prior to the establishment of the euro, there was an agreement that the countries have to satisfy some conditions to enter the eurozone. And those conditions were how much the deficit should be, fiscal deficit should be, that was 3% of GDP. The debt should not exceed 60% of GDP, but if it does, it should continuously decline toward 60% of deficit. There was a criterion on inflation, basically to have low inflation, and the criteria on long-term interest rate, basically to say that long-term interest rates should also be low. And there was a criteria on the exchange rate. For 2 years prior entering the eurozone, you had to maintain the exchange rate within a relatively narrow margin. And the countries satisfied those criteria, the countries that wanted to enter the eurozone. However, once they were within the eurozone, they started to misbehave. the deficits have been increasing, inflation has been higher, and then rules were required to instill discipline into the countries. And one of those, that rule was the Stability and Growth Pact. And the Stability and Growth Pact prescribed that a country should not have a deficit higher than 3% of GDP. But if it does, it's subject to excessive deficit procedure, which means that recommendations are made by the council of what the country should do. And if the country does not do those actions, then a fine can be levied. The fine was a non-interest-bearing deposit with the European Central Bank. The first two sinners were Germany and France. They were subject to a fine. But to confirm, well, the Commission suggested the fine, that for the fine to be actually levied, the Council has to be decided with two-third majority, and that two-third majority was not obtained within the Council. Therefore, they did not have to make those non-interest-bearing deposits. Then, some reforms were introduced in the Stability and Growth Pact, which made a little bit more flexible, actually, the procedure, the excessive deficit procedure. And now I come to what I wanted to say, what's happening today under the presidency. When the 2008-2009 crisis broke up, there became an awareness that you have to have much stricter rules, not much stricter rules to avoid crises of this nature in the future. So there are six rules that already have been actually approved by the Council of by the European Council, and those six rules are the following. Not only the deficit is being taken into account, but also the debt. So you can be under excessive deficit procedure when your debt exceeds 60%. Okay? Prior, it was only if your deficit exceeded 3%, and there was no talk about the debt. Now, if the debt exceeds 60%, even if your deficit is under 3%, you can be under excessive deficit procedure. The second thing is that there is also a so-called excessive macroeconomic imbalances procedure. They look at some indicators like balance of payments, the current account of the balance of payments, the trade balance, the foreign direct investment, external indebtedness, several such indicators. The benchmarks are being established for that. And if you exceed the benchmark, there will be red flags. And if you have many red flags, then it means that you could be subject to excessive macroeconomic procedure as well. The third part of it is that the system of the penalties have been made more progressive. The first time you have to make a deposit, but it's an interest-bearing deposit. The second time, if you don't follow the recommendations of the Commission and the Council, then you have to make a deposit which does not pay interest. And the third time, it's taken away. By making it more progressive, the hope is that it would be more acceptable to countries, that it would entice countries to accept the recommendations and take corrective actions more willingly, perhaps. And the fourth element of this is that you have to establish fiscal rules. It can be a rule of how much your deficit can be. For instance, you can have a fiscal rule put in the constitution. Hungary is planning to, has already put into the new constitution that the deficit cannot exceed 50%. And if it does, all the time while the debt is more than 50%, the deficit cannot increase. So you can put it in the constitution if you want, or just a law. It can be a rule on the growth of expenditures, for instance. It doesn't say what it should be, but it says that there should be rules, fiscal rules, governing the fiscal policy. And then there is a requirement also on the budgetary procedures. That includes what type of statistics there should be provided, what should be the budgetary procedure, etc. So this is what is the package of strengthening economic governance. That has already been approved by the Council. Now the European Parliament has to approve it. And this is the first time that, because of the Lisbon Treaty, the European Parliament has a say in economic policies. It didn't have that before. So now maybe in the European Parliament, the parliamentarians want to show that they have a say, and we don't know how much they feel the time pressure to approve these rules, and how much of the discussion, how long the discussions would take place. But here again, the Hungarian government will have a role to play to try to persuade the MPs of the European Parliament to proceed fast, because it's necessary that these rules take into effect as soon as possible. So this is a very important step forward, because if it would mean the economic governance is and cooperation really is much strengthened, and hopefully in the future it will avoid the type of crises that we have faced in 2008-2009. There is also what is called the Europe Plus. Because what I have said now, the six rules, they apply to all European Union members. However, for those who are in the Eurozone, there is a separate agreement, a pact. Originally, it was called a pact, but it's now called Euro Plus, which sets additional conditions for cooperation between the members of the Eurozone, such things like de-indexing wages or increasing the pension age, all this in order to strengthen competitiveness in the future. And the members of the Eurozone have accepted that. And non-Eurozone members can join into this Euro Plus agreement, and many non-members have joined. Hungary hasn't, because Hungary is satisfying actually all the criteria except or plans to satisfy all the criteria, increasing pension, indexing wages. Actually, wages are not indexed in Hungary. It's a result of an agreement that every year it's reached between the employers and the employees, but it's not an automatic indexation. But one of the requirement of the pact is to equalize the tax base for companies. And Hungary has one of the lowest taxes for companies, and Hungary wants to keep that for competitive purposes, and therefore hasn't joined the has not joined the pact. Now let me talk a little bit about the human touch part of it, of the European Hungarian presidency, and that is the Roma integration. Romas are the gypsies in Hungary. Now few people know that there are about 10 to 12 million gypsies, Romas, in Central and Eastern Europe. In some countries it reaches almost 10%. In Hungary it's around 7 or 8% of the population. And the unemployment rate among the Romas is 85%. And there are calculations that show that by 2020, about 20% of the new entrants of the labor force in Hungary will be from Romas. So it's very, very important, the Roma integration. And one of the most important aspects of it is education. These people are very much undereducated. Many of them don't even finish school. And Hungary wants to elevate this, the awareness of Roma integration, to the European level, so that a framework is decided on which each country can then build up his own approach to Roma integration. And Hungary is doing its bit of this. There is a first time a Secretary of State who is in charge of Roma integration and developing policies, which then can be emulated by the other countries. Another part of it is, would be the last point of the European integration that I would, the European presidency that I would mention, is the enlargement. Hungary is very much in favor of bringing into the hold of Europe Croatia, and is trying to do everything that it can to make sure that Croatia would be accepted as a member of the European Union during the Hungarian presidency that ends in end June. There are still some outstanding issues that have not been resolved, but Hungary hopes that these issues will be resolved before the end of June. Let me say something about the Eurozone a little bit. There have been a lot of criticism nowadays of the Eurozone, that the Euro is unviable, it would break up because of the difficulties that we have Greece, Portugal, and Ireland. Let me tell you that I don't think so. There is a very, very strong commitment on the part of European politicians, be that from left or right or conservative or liberals. This has been a project for the last 50 years. The elimination of exchange rate fluctuations between countries that are as much integrated as the European Union countries are, economically, financially, trade, elimination of the exchange rate risk is a very, very big step forward. Can you imagine if in the United States each state had a different currency, what it would mean? And the integration of these countries is very strong. There are differences between the United States and Europe, which makes the task of establishing a single currency in Europe more difficult than in the United States. You have the labor market is not flexible. The flow of labor from one country to the other for cultural reason, etc., well-known reason is much more restricted. The portability of social benefits like pensions, health care is not assured. It might come one day, but it's not yet done. So it's much more difficult to create conditions for a monetary union. That said, it's still in the interest of the those countries, and one could not compare the Eurozone, say, to the United States, as has been done sometimes, when they say that the European markets are not as integrated as the U.S. market. It's not the comparison to the United States that you have to make, but the comparison of Eurozone without the Eurozone. What would have happened in 2008, 2009, when the crisis hit, if each country had its own currency? It would have been terrible. Currencies would have gone up and down. Interest rates have gone up and down. And that would have been much, much more difficult. The fact that there was a unified monetary union helped to weaken the shocks that the crisis created. So the need is to strengthen the European Monetary Union, and this is why this economic governance measures have been introduced. And it will continue to be more difficult. Building Europe has been shock by shock, you know, many, many times. You needed a crisis to make another step forward. And when the crisis came, then the people started to discuss, and very often you reach the conclusion in the 25th hour of the deadline. So I think it will continue like that, but I am pretty sure that the Eurozone will stand, because this is in the interest of the member states. I would like to stop here, and I would say that I can talk 25 minutes. I think I kept to the time, and I am would be very pleased to answer your questions.
Thank you. Our thanks to Ambassador George Szapary, Ambassador of Hungary to the United States. It's now time for our question and answer period, and we've received a number of Commonwealth Club cards with questions. Let me just dive in here. We have several questions about interest rates. The European Central Bank recently raised interest rates. What effect do you think, Mr. Ambassador, this will have on inflation in the EU?
Well, the idea of raising interest rates for a central bank is to reduce the rate of inflation. So the European Central Bank has increased interest rates because it so pressures inflationary pressures in the economy. And the central bank has always had to act before the inflation increases, because the effect of monetary policy is very much delayed. You know, generally we say that in an economy like the United States or the European Union, the effect of an increase in interest rates on inflation will have a lag of 18 months to 2 years. So a central bank, when it sees the pressures coming, wage increases, energy increases, food price increases. These are the two major sources of inflation right now in Europe, but also in the United States. Food price increases and energy price increases. Then, forcing that, they increase the interest rate so that inflation will not not increase. So that is the role of interest rate. That's the role of the central banks.
But this is a different approach than the U.S. Federal Reserve has taken, yes?
It is a different approach. In the United States, the inflationary pressures appear to be less than in Europe. Secondly, the United States' manufacturing sector is very strong. During the recession, it has rationalized. Actually, during the recession, productivity has increased, which is a very very rare thing to happen. They have taken advantage of the low interest rates and refinanced their debt. So they are in a very strong position. Productivity is increased. Their cash position and their debt position is very favorable. What is lacking in the United States is demand. Not enough demand. So the United States can afford to have low interest rate to stimulate demand and also a fiscal policy relatively looser than in Europe because the deficit, the debt is not as high in some of the countries in Europe. In some of the countries in Europe are 100% of GDP. So the United States has more room to stimulate demand and the manufacturing sector is well positioned to satisfy that. Demand. Additionally, the financial sector in the United States is in a much better shape now than it is in Europe. Most of the debt, most of the credit that the United States banks have taken from the government has been repaid. In Europe, the banking system is much weaker. As of now, much more measures will have to be taken to strengthen the banking system. And that is also, a factor that is holding back the economic growth in Europe. The growth in credit is very very limited. In some countries, the outstanding credit is actually declining because the banks have... don't have enough capital, so they have to save for the capital. For the bad loan portfolio, they have to provision additional capital. They have also become more prudent. So as a result of that, credit expansion is very weak, and that does not help economic growth.
One of our attendees today asks on exactly that point, how much of this fiscal crisis in Europe is due to loose fiscal policies of banks and were there failures, as you've just covered, that required government bailouts, or do banks rule? I would ask, what are the regulatory procedures now, and will the EU begin to take some oversight?
Yes, the EU is already has taken measures to strengthen oversight, bank supervision. The crisis in Europe is both loose fiscal policy. You know, in good times, actually the Stability and Growth Pact says that in good times you have to tend toward approximate balance of the fiscal position. so that when the bad times come, you can have the so-called let the so-called automatic stabilizers to work, which means that you can have your deficit increasing when there is a recession. Now, during the good times, countries in Europe did not accumulate or create more room. Actually, they were very close to the 3% deficit, or they were in excess of the 3% deficit. So when the crisis came, then the deficits and the debt ballooned. So that's one part of the problem. The other part on the banking side is that in some countries, like the UK or Germany, where London and Frankfurt are big international financial centers, so that a lot of big banks that ended up with toxic assets, not just like in the United States, but compared to the fiscal position of those countries, the financial sector was much bigger. So when they had to bail out those banks, it meant a much bigger burden on the budget of those countries. Just like in Ireland, but also to a larger extent, the case was also in with the banking system in the UK and Germany. Now the reaction to this is that you have to strengthen supervision. This is the right reaction, and there have been a number of steps taken in Europe, establishing a European-wide supervision system. It's not an agency as such that each country has its own supervisory agency, but it's something that it's an agency that coordinates supervision, and also the European Central Bank is overseeing the macroeconomic. The systemic risk part of it that is due to macroeconomic imbalances in an economy.
We have several questions about that strengthening a central power. How much longer before the EU Confederation becomes a republic? What about Germany?
Well, you know, I think at this point, no one wants in Europe a federal republic. Maybe it will come someday, I don't know. The key question really is that you don't have a central fiscal policy. You have a central monetary policy, but you don't have a central fiscal policy. This is why the Stability and Growth Pact was created in the first place, with rules. It might be that over time, but it's in the very long term, that there would be more of a coordination of more of a role for a central fiscal policy. At this point, nobody wants to do that. Every country wants to have its own tax policy, its own expenditure policy, its own social policy, etc. That said, you can achieve coordination if you abide by those rules that have been now agreed upon. But I would say a federal Europe is not in the cards for the foreseeable future. Germany, of course, is the most important economy within the EU, and the European integration has been built on German-French cooperation. If Germany and France were pushing something forward, then things went advanced. If they were in a mode where they were not very active on the European scene, then not much was happening on the European scene. So those countries were really the engines of European integration. And I think they will remain the engines of European integration because more countries are not in the same position to take over the leadership of European integration. And so it's very important what Germany does, if that was the end, that was behind the question. Very important what Germany does. It's very important that Germany supports the European Union integration, and it does.
You had touched on expansion of the EU and Hungary's positive outlook towards Croatia. Could you talk about some of the other potential EU members?
Yes, there is Montenegro, Serbia, then Macedonia that are, you know, in different stages of the European integration. It will take more time before they would be actually admitted to the European Union. Hungary is obviously very much interested that the countries in the Balkans should be a member of the European Union because it's close to Hungary, and it's important stability that European union membership brings to the country, political, economic stability. That's important. But each country has different issues involved. Macedonia, for instance, the question of the name of the country. Also, one has to take into account that on the old members on the European side, there seems to be a sort of enlargement fatigue. You know, suddenly a lot of countries became members, and then with the crisis and the difficulties that you have in some of the member countries, they're concentrating on these issues, and maybe there is some sort of enlargement fatigue. But I would say, over time, very likely that more members from the Balkan, more countries from the Balkan will become members of the European Union.
We've recently heard in the news, too, it's been commented on, about a two-tier system for some of the countries. You're not in favor of that, I gather.
Well, you're not in favor of two-tier system. It might happen because of the economic developments. Originally, people thought that a two-tier system would be that there would be a separate club of people who would be agreeing on some of the things and the others will not. That did not really happen because the Europe Plus has been accepted by all the members of the Eurozone, plus almost all the countries which are not members of the Eurozone. A two-speed is also mentioned regarding economic development, that some countries grow faster than the others. Well, okay, this is happening. I mean, some countries are going faster, like Germany is growing down faster, Portugal is falling behind. But you cannot say that this will be a two-speed forever. Things change, and some of the countries that have been growing fast, something happens in that country, in the economic policy, or how they react to a crisis, and then a fast-growing economy can be a slower-growing economy. Ireland is a case in point for that. And then a slow-growing economy later on can become a higher. So I wouldn't say that there is definitely a two-speed economic path within the European Union that would last for a long period of time. It will be changing.
You're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program. Our guest today is Dr. George Szapary, Ambassador of Hungary to the United States, who's discussing challenges facing the European Union. We have some questions regarding, switching from the economic here, regarding the Schengen Agreement, which is the free passage of immigrants. Is the proposed repeal racially motivated, and what do you think of its likelihood of success?
I'm sorry, the question is regarding Schengen?
Yes.
The Schengen zone means that there are no borders between countries that have that have entered the Schengen zone. All the countries of the European Union, except Romania and Bulgaria, are members of the Schengen zone. This is a little bit different from the immigration in the way of Schengen zone does not automatically mean that you can take and work in that particular country. You can travel in that country. However, in most countries within the European Union now, the restrictions on labor from the members of the European Union have been lifted, not all, but in most it has been lifted. There has been a very big migration of labor from Central and Eastern Europe toward Germany, UK, Ireland, coming from Poland, Hungary, Romania. That has helped the economic development of those countries when the times were good. Now that the times are bad, you know, many of these countries return home. Some of them stay, of course, in the country and are unemployed. But I would say that over time, once we get out of this crisis, the movement between people and the movement of labor force between the country would increase.
One of our attendees notes that Sarkozy and Berlusconi recently launched an effort to suspend passport-free travel within the EU. Do you think the EU will respond to this? Will it be more common?
They've been talking about it because what France and Italy is worried about is that with the event in the Middle East, the refugees from the Middle East come to one country, say to Romania or maybe to Hungary, because these are the outside borders of the European Union. Romania is not a Schengen country, but arrive to a Schengen country that the outside borders are not as much defended as would Italy and France defend its outside borders. And therefore, the immigrants would arrive there, and then from there they would go to Italy and France, where they were, or to some other countries where they, the possibilities of finding work seem to be more attractive to the immigrants. There is, you know, they have raised this issue. I don't know what will come out of it.
We have a couple of questions back to the economic questions here. Does the EU feel pressure from China? And we talk about it a lot in the United States in terms of manufacturing and outsourcing and growth issues. If so, do you find that economic pressure from China, and do you think the EU will find a different experience and reaction, will have a different experience and reaction to the United States than the United States, pardon me?
Well, clearly, China has emerged as a very important economic power, which to some extent right now is the fastest growing important country and provides some steam to the economic growth in Europe and the United States. Particularly in Europe, exports of Germany to China are growing very fast, of which, for instance, a country like Hungary benefits because Hungary is producing inputs into exports of Germany. To some extent, China is pulling also the Hungarian economy. Clearly, China is becoming more and more important in economic in the world economy, and it is having a very large amount of reserves, and how it uses those reserves influence the world economy. Yes, the world is changing, and you have to adapt. You have to adapt to those changing situations.
Thank you. We've had several questions about the issue, a large issue in the EU, concerning human trafficking. One of our questioners today says human trafficking is one of the greatest challenges for governments across Europe. How and what steps has the EU taken to stop this?
Well, I know little about human trafficking in Europe and what are the measures in particular being taken. So I cannot really answer because I'm not familiar with this issue.
Well, maybe we could turn to some questions specifically regarding Hungary. One of our attendees today says, looking back through 1950, I'm surprised at several things. We never had a nuclear war. He or she is surprised at the dissolution of the USSR and the end of the Iron Curtain, and asks, what is your perspective as a Hungarian?
About nuclear war or?
Looking back through the 1950, this person is surprised at that we've never had a nuclear war and the dissolution of the USSR. What changes have you seen since 1950 for Hungary?
Well, the biggest change is the collapse of communism. I mean, you know, when you lived in Central and Eastern Europe and you had the Soviet army there, you was very difficult to imagine that one day that would end. And then came 1956, the uprising, and then the Russians, the Soviet army came in and crushed it. And then there was 1968 in Prague, and the Soviet army walked in. So people did not think that in their lifetime the communism would collapse and these countries would be free democracy. I did begin to think that we lived the time that communism would break open, that I would live the time when communism would collapse. It was first in 1980 with the events in Poland where the Soviet army didn't crush it. It put pressure, obviously, on it, but it let the Jaruzelski and the Polish Communist Party to deal with the situation. So that was a big change compared to Budapest and Prague. And then came the meeting between Reagan and Gorbachev in Iceland, in Reykjavik. There, you know, started to sense, because there was some agreement there. And then there was another meeting between President Reagan and Gorbachev in Malta. Then I thought, okay, I think pretty sure that I will live the time. But then came the event of the reburial of Imre Nagy, who was the leader, to some extent, the prime minister during the Hungarian Revolution in 1956. And the prime minister was executed and buried somewhere that people generally didn't know where he was buried. And then later they found his remains. And there was a public reburial on June 16, 1989. And then I sensed that there's something going to happen. I was still in Washington. I took the airplane and I asked my son, who just finished college at Brown University, I think, this is a historic event, why don't you come? And I was there, standing there at the Hero Square, and, you know, there were a few speeches coming, you know, former people who were involved in the revolution in 1956. And then came a young man, about 26 years old, and made a very tough speech and demanded publicly the withdrawal of the Soviet army, under the shadow of the Soviet army. And that man is today the Prime Minister of Hungary, Viktor Orban. And then I sensed that and nothing happened. So the Russia, of course, the Soviet army kept far away from this. The police didn't come in and didn't intervene. So that I said, you know, dictatorships are such that, like an apple, when they arrive, they fall. And I sensed then that they were arrived to fall. You know, they didn't have the strength anymore to crush. And I knew that this will happen not just in Hungary, but the collapse would be total, because the dictatorship came from, you know, communism was imposed by the Soviet Union. If they don't have the power, the willingness to maintain, then, you know, one country after the other would collapse. And in fact, by November, the Berlin Wall fell. So I would say this is the biggest change since 1950. No, of course, the next biggest change will be what will happen in the rest of the world. What will happen in North Africa, in the Middle East? What will happen in Afghanistan, in Iraq, in Iran? So the how would I say, the things to solve, in a way, have moved into another part of the globe, and we face that, and we will have to deal with it.
Can you talk a little bit, please, about the new constitution that's been adopted in Hungary?
Yes, I still talk about current constitution, because the new constitutions will take effect on the 1st of January next year. The current constitution was established by a round table in 1989, where the on the one side were sitting the communists and the other side were sitting the opposition parties. Hungary, in fact, was the first country under the communists that started negotiating with the Communist Party toward free elections. During these negotiations, what happened, that two sides, they were very distrustful from each other, were sitting around the table and took the valid constitution, which was a constitution adopted in 1949, started to make changes to it. But what came out of it is a constitution that was based on compromises. Second, it was a constitution that was not adopted by an elected body. It was not yet adopted by an elected body. And it said in the very first sentence that this is a temporary constitution. And over the last 20 years, each government, each party wanted to change the constitution, but never had the majority needed, because you need two-thirds majority to change the constitution. Now, this constitution, this government has the two-thirds majority and set out to change the constitution. What I could say, because you know, I've also read the criticism in the newspaper, that I would say it's actually strengthening democracy, human rights. It includes the European Charter of Human Rights in the constitution, and it does have the objective also to strengthen Hungary as a nation. You know, I was very much impressed when I went to the university, the graduation of my son, and this speaker, I don't know who he was, but it's a known person, but I don't remember his name. He quoted Robert Frost, and he said, Frost said that don't join too many teams, use that word, too many teams in your life, but join one. Your family, your nation, and your alma mater. And that was very good. I have since then quoted him several times. And you need, because this is what holds together a society, family, and then the nation. You have to have the nation. The communists try to destroy that feeling that you belong to a nation. So you have to give back that. That's very important. The society lives on some teams, not too many teams. You know, if you have one or two or three, okay, I agree with Foster that there should be three. That is also an objective of the Constitution, but it does not infringe at all on human rights, on democracy.
As the president of the Council of the European Union, could you speak to the role that Hungary will play in the politics of a unified Europe?
Well, you know, Hungarians are activists, and you can see that also among the Hungarian Americans here in the United States. It's a creative population, so I am sure they will try to play an active role. But Hungary is also a small country, so small countries have less of a weight within the European Union. However, they can play very important roles because they can further compromises if there are differences among big countries. Then if they have good ideas and they come forward with good ideas and that over time can be accepted. There are some small countries that have played very important roles. I'm thinking, for instance, the Netherlands or even Luxembourg, a small country, furthering some items on the agenda that are important. So you can play an important role, and I am sure, knowing the Hungarians, they will want to play an important role.
Well, we've reached the point in our program where there's time for only one last question. One of our guests today asks, do you have any advice for President Obama?
Thank you. Well, I don't.
That's a very wise statement from an activist.
But because I don't know enough about the... I can talk about economics because I've been an economist. I only can tell you that... I said that also yesterday, and I see some of the people who are here yesterday. I said yesterday that I feel that I'm in a very privileged job here in the United States because I represent a country that I love in a country that I love.
Good conclusion. Thank you very much, Ambassador Sarkozy. We also want to thank our audiences here and on the radio, television, and the Internet. I'm Barbara Pivnicka, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know, is adjourned.